these were part of our history. This is what this ideology was. And this is what people lived through. And now you come and see the statues and you can see the people, the way that this ideology was manifested on the streets.
Statues and public monuments are important civic landmarks. But what can instating and remove them say about the city and its relationship to the past? Maybe it's the case that, as Barack Obama once said, history doesn't always move in a straight line.
But we haven't destroyed it. We're not saying this never happened. This happened. We lived through it. These were the upsides, these were the downsides. And now you can have a think about that, about what it means.
But maybe today it's time to think a little more carefully about what our monuments actually commemorate. We'll find out the novel way in which urban design helped Budapest come to grips with its Soviet past, today on Section D. This is Section D, Monocle's weekly design show, and I'm your host, Josh Fennett. Also, today...
When we speak about design and the digital in general, and in robotics, of course, what we speak about is the interaction and the relation, maybe even most importantly, the relation.
With so many technology companies putting form and fripperies before function, we'll look at a fresh set of high-tech designs that add brains to beauty in Vienna. And...
We have to give up the notion of building monuments and really figure out how to make an architecture that, if even for a moment, connects us and opens up our world.
We also talked to the author of a new book who distilled his love and awe with architecture and the built environment and added a little context on where the discipline is heading into an indispensable new volume. All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. Few news watchers will have missed the report of deadly violence at a rally of white supremacists in the US city of Charlottesville. The confrontation initially centered around the removal of a Confederate statue of the Southern General Robert E. Lee. And aside from providing another less than satisfactory chapter in the gaffe-prone presidency of one Donald Trump, the episode sparked debate over how the United States has and should deal with its undesirable Confederate past. But needless to say, the US isn't alone in needing to confront a difficult history that comes to a head in the concrete form of a statue. Many former Soviet states have been forced to face uncomfortable questions over how to deal with monuments and statues that were originally designed to celebrate now-defunct ideologies. Some nations, such as Ukraine, have banned Soviet symbolism, but Hungary has taken a different approach to its Eastern European cousins. Memento Park opened in 1993, just a few years after the collapse of the Iron Curtain. By welcoming visitors to learn about the nation's history, the park presents the city's polarizing symbolism in a brand new context. Monocle's Budapest correspondent, Adam Labor, takes us on a tour.
In October 1944, when the Red Army crossed into Hungary, the Hungarians welcomed them as liberators. But in Budapest, the fighting was at its fiercest.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
The chief state TV channel was halfway through its evening news when it got the first details of the agreement signed in Minsk. Quoting from it, the anchorwoman announced, "The Soviet Union, as a subject of international and geopolitical reality, no longer exists."
The Memento Park, or as we call it sometimes in Budapest, the Statue Park, is a large area just outside the city where all the statues of the communist era, Lenin and Marx and heroic Soviet soldiers, have been placed. And the idea was that after communism, people said, well, what should we do with these statues? So some people were saying they should be destroyed. Some people were saying they should be left in place. Not many. Most people wanted them moved out. But a very sensible decision was taken to keep them because they are part of Hungary's history. And the positioning of the statue park in itself is also very interesting because it's not in the centre of the city. It's not in the middle of nowhere. It's just outside the city. It's about 45 minutes to get there. So it sort of shows the ambiguity of Hungary's relationship with communism. Because under communism, Hungary was known as the happiest barracks or as having goulash communism. And there was a sort of social contract that if you don't make too much trouble, we'll let you go to Austria every 2 or 3 years. We'll let you do a bit of smuggling. You can have some Western goods, a bit of private enterprise. You know, people weren't being tortured or really beaten up in Hungary by the late 1980s. So it was a sort of softish communism. It was still a dictatorship. So nowadays, many people, especially older people that haven't really managed to make the transition to the much tougher free market economy, remember those days with some sympathy and with some affection. So the statue park represents that ambiguity of the country's relationship with communism. I can't imagine you'd go there if you didn't know anything, because the more about the history that you know, even just the basic idea that Eastern Europe was under communist rule from after the Second World War till 1990 would give you an understanding of it. But the word looming is very good. A lot of Soviet era and Soviet-style architecture does kind of loom over you. And that was intentional to show the kind of grandeur of the system, that great forces were at play, that these statues of these leaders, Lenin, Marx and Engels, they were kind of the inventors and the interpreters of really grand historical forces that shaped lives and made new societies. And so you were meant to be almost a bit intimidated by them. So you would come in and you would see Lenin and Marx and Engels, you would see some statues of Soviet soldiers. There's one statue there called Ostapenko, which is a Russian soldier holding a white flag. And that used to be on the outskirts of Budapest. And that some people, quite a lot of people, said that should have stayed, because everyone knew that when they came back from their summer holiday at Lake Balaton, they went past Ostapenko's statue. They were back in the city. And his story was that him and a couple of other Russian soldiers, at the end of the war, when the Germans were retreating and the Russians were advancing, went forward with a white flag to say, look, you know, we're on the way, you're done, so why don't you surrender? But he was shot, so they turned him into a kind of a martyr. So there's a lot of the city's history there. If you go there with some knowledge of the city's history, you get a lot out of the visit. It's also very well explained. It's not just a load of statues in a field. It's quite a well-organized theme park. You can listen to speeches of former communist leaders. There's quite a lot of jokey souvenirs you can buy. But I think it's a very good place. It's good that it exists and that these statues have been kept. And some of them are quite amazing pieces of art. It's very interesting because in the city, under communism, these statues in major downtown places. I mean, I remember in 1991, Marx and Engels were still in a park. Right by the Margaret Bridge near the Danube. But that statue now has been moved to the Memento Park. They were certainly intended to, at least, if not intimidate you, remind you, you know, you are in a communist country. Lenin's sayings are to be revered and to be obeyed. These are the people that have made the ideology that shapes your life. So it was sending a very clear message.
President Truman's dramatic announcement that Russia has created an atomic explosion sends reporters racing for Flushing Meadow, where Russia's Vyshinsky arrives to address the United Nations.
Mr. Vyshinsky, have you got any statement about President Truman's statement on the atomic bomb?
Please, excuse me.
Does Russia have the atomic bomb?
It's saying that these were part of our history. This is what this ideology was. And this is what people lived through. And now you come and see the statues and you can see the people, the way that this ideology was manifested on the streets. But we haven't destroyed it. We're not saying this never happened. This happened. We lived through it. These were the upsides. These were the downsides. And now you can have a think about that, about what it means. I think, for example, if you look at what's happening in America over the statues of the Confederate generals, rather than taking them down and smashing them, to put them in something similar, built around, obviously, the idea of the Confederacy, the Civil War, slavery, and its continuing reverberations in American society, which are obviously extremely strong, would be a very sensible way forward, because what it does is it takes them, it kind of quarantines them in a way. It takes them out of the everyday furious debates and anger and claim and counterclaim, and it says, it happened, they're here, they're in this context, go and look at them. You can think about why these statues were built. What were the people thinking? Good things or bad things? And discuss it and talk about it, because I think discussing and talking about these things is a much better way forward than ripping them down all the time. Because if you rip them down, it just increases the rancor and the anger on both sides. I think the fact that it's there and it's available as a resource is a very good thing. And it would be great if, you know, for example, school children were taken there and shown around to say this is what the history is. I mean, history in Central and Eastern Europe is very, very live and very sensitive subject. So the fact that it's there, it's waiting, is good.
That was Monocle's Budapest correspondent, Adam Labor, there, walking us through the city's Memento Park. Now for a quick aside. While most designers, architects and city planners work towards improving some aspect of urban life, others are charged with a less straightforward brief of creating spaces or monuments that commemorate less palatable parts of a city's past. Still, other statues bear meanings that have changed over time. For more than two decades, during the mid-19th century, Friedrich Engels, Marx's co-author on the Communist Manifesto, lived in the British city of Manchester. Together with Marx, he honed Marxist theory and, in 1845, published The Condition of the Working Class in England, based upon his research. As of this year, a statue of Engels now stands in the city of Manchester, after taking a long and unlikely journey from a village in eastern Ukraine, following that country's ban on Soviet symbols. The artist behind its transportation, Phil Collins, no relation we're assured, says he hopes the statue will shine a light on the contradictions of today's economic values here in the UK. Proof, if it were needed, that the significance of these pieces are often in the eye of the beholder. The Metaphorical Section D mailbag is always open to queries and suggestions. Do get in touch by emailing our producer, Ben Rylan. He can be contacted at br@monocle.com. This is Section D. Do stay tuned. Next up, we flick through the pages of a beautiful new book for inspiration. Moving swiftly between critique and wide-eyed admiration for his subject, architect and curator Aaron Betsky's new book reminds readers about architecture's responsibility to make things better as well as to dazzle and delight. If the new title itself were a building, it would be an understated but important one, more Mies van der Rohe's Barcelona pavilion than the Burj Khalifa. The lessons it offers are as favourable as the comparison suggests. I spoke to the architect, author, curator and dean of the Frank Lloyd Wright School of Architecture, Aaron Betsky, about his book for Thames and Hudson entitled Architecture Matters.
Sitting here at Taliesin, the home and studio that Frank Lloyd Wright built for himself in starting at the beginning of the 20th century, where I run the School of Architecture here, and I'm always sitting with students as we're trying to figure out how to design buildings, just telling them to look around them, look at how the light is coming in, look at what's holding up the ceiling, look at how the levels change, look at how you move through the space. And it's just that kind of awareness of the immediate ability of architecture to reveal aspects of the world all around you, from simple things like the light to complex issues like how you find yourself at home in this very complex modern world we live in. And I think the big idea there is that if you look carefully enough, and I always tell my students, architecture is first and foremost about seeing and then knowing what you're seeing. If you do that, the buildings in which we live, the designed environment that we've inherited, is a way of knowing our world, knowing our culture, knowing where we've come from, where we are, and then where we might be going. And I would hope that if you've learned how to look hard enough, and if you've thought about what you're seeing with enough focus, you will be able to use your skills and knowledge as a designer to make the world we all inhabit collectively better, to make it more sustainable, to make it more beautiful, to make it more available to all kinds of people. I think that architecture can have a very strong impact in the way that our world works and should work. And I'm hoping that one of the ways it gets there is by long and hard looking, and I hope that that's what this book encourages.
And one aspect of the book which I particularly loved as I waded through it was your addressing of the nitty-gritty, the things that an architect needs to be. They need to be a designer, I suppose. They need to be a dreamer. They need to be a collaborator. They also need to be a salesman. And obviously, being in the home of Frank Lloyd Wright, you're well suited to answer this. He was a notorious hustler who rarely delivered on budget. But, you know, how much are the practicalities of architecture also something that we need to discuss? Not just the beautiful edifices that define a generation or make a particular city mayor look good, but also the kind of graft and getting stuff built and the compromises and the day-to-day that go into it. How much was that something you wanted to shine a light on, would you say?
Oh, I think it's absolutely central. But, you know, it's interesting because most of the time people try to teach those things as courses. We have courses called professional practice in which you learn how to get jobs and how to make money off of them. Frank Lloyd Wright had another attitude, and one that I also have tried to convey in this book, which is that you learn to be an effective citizen of your world. And so here at Taliesin, our students have to not just learn architecture, they have to help cook, but they also have to be part of social events that we organize on a regular basis and learn how to mingle with people, how to talk to people, to have a broader perspective. That's how you ultimately become a successful architect, not by being a design nerd, however much we all love design, but by using your particular perspective as part of a wider cultural conversation and learning how to insert what you think is important, what you believe in passionately, within a larger economic and social context. And that, to me, is also of importance. What I try to show in the book is, yes, you have to know certain tricks, but in some of the anecdotes I tell about architects behaving well or behaving badly, it's all about being socially adept people, being able to look people in the eye and shake people's hands and talk to their concerns and listen to them really well. That's really what matters, not learning just how to do your sums.
Sure. And I've almost finished the book. I'm on chapter 37 of 46. And the most recent one that I read has a slightly counterintuitive title. It's Why You Shouldn't Build. And I just wanted to ask you, you know, we see architects and designers and urban planners as the people who shape our cities. But I'm intrigued to hear your thoughts on how our cities are shaped, how our ideas and the way that we see the built environment is shaped by things that don't always, you know, make a dent, that never actually often break ground. How important are the architects that supply these kind of ideas that never get built?
Oh, I think they're of vital importance, and I think they will become ever more important as we realize that we live in a more ephemeral world, that how things work is becoming ever more miniaturized and every more ephemeral, like the conversation that we're having now across continents, but also as we realize that we really cannot afford to use up resources that we can no longer renew, space that should be open and shared by all, and also as we realize that buildings are very clunky structures that not only use up those resources, but exclude people as much as they include them, are built for a purpose that changes almost as soon as the building is done, if not way before, and that once we're meant to monumentalize those who had the power and the money to build them, but now are supposed to be places that, as you say, enable the social life of our environments, of our cities, of our suburbs, and that, by the way, is very important to me, that we look not just at our cities, but at all of the life beyond that, where over half the population in the Western world now lives. That is of vital importance, and that means that architecture is something that you do not just with buildings, but you do with visions, with novels. You also do it with interiors. You know, most architects, when they get going, they'll design a coffee shop, or a disco, or a store, and they'll have much greater freedom to create visions in those places, and they'll be torn out in a few years and I hope recycled, but they can develop something much more flexible. And these days we're even seeing architects, I think for instance of Assemble right there in England, who create architecture by just having something occur even for a moment in a public space. That to me is an architecture that is more in tune with how we lead our lives, how we connect with each other, how we affect social change. We have to give up the notion of building monuments and really figure out how to make an architecture that, if even for a moment, connects us and opens up our world.
Finally today, design is inextricably linked with the advent of new technology, from computer learning to 3D printing and voice recognition software. And the media is full of fanciful claims about how these will shape the world of the future. Often without expertise or qualification, and sometimes without much sense of how these great bounds forward will actually impact our lives. This year's Vienna Biennale tackles the technology glut rather neatly by narrowing its gaze to examine the specific role of robotics. Monocle's Alexei Korolev reports from one exhibition that asks some particularly pressing questions.
Robots, can we trust them? Are they friend or foe? Can they feel? Do we care what they feel? And who controls who? These are the questions that are explored in a new exhibition called Hello Robot, designed between human and machine at Vienna's Museum of Applied Arts. It's part of the Vienna Biennale 2017, devoted to robotics and its impact on our work and everyday life.
So basically what we do with Hello Robot is really approaching this other species, getting closer and closer from a very distance perspective in the beginning to really becoming one with the robot at the end, where we speak about robotic architecture, so we live inside a robot, or prostheses and implants, etc., the robot living inside us.
Und die erste Frage, die sich hier einem gleich stellt, haben Sie schon jenen Roboter getroffen? Die meisten sagen nein. Warum? Weil sie natürlich genau das hier erwarten.
Amelie Klein of the Vitra Design Museum in Germany is one of four curators of Hello Robot.
We are asking 14 questions that seem a bit naive at first, but if you think about them really closely and if you're really honest, you realize that you cannot really answer them by a straight yes or a straight no. Rather, you'd have to admit that it's both yes and no. And this is really something that we're trying to do. We're trying to embrace both extremes. The yes technology is amazing and exciting and awesome and will help us in many, many ways. And yet, at the same time, you know, it bears a lot of critical aspects.
Let the woman go. You are under arrest.
Thank you.
Madam, you have suffered an emotional shock. I will notify a rape crisis center.
The questions seem, as I said, they seem naive, like, have you ever met a robot? Do we actually need robots? Are robots our friends or enemies? Do you trust robots? Could a robot take your job? How do you feel about objects having feelings? Would you want to be taken care of by a robot? Do you believe in death and rebirth of objects? And then in the end, do you want to become better than nature intended? Would you live in a robot? Again, these questions seem simple. Yet if you take, for example, the ones in the third part where we speak about robots as our friends and helpers, our smart assistants, how much do you really want to rely on those smart assistants? How much do we already rely on these smart assistants? And why do we think that as we rely on them, they will follow the same agenda that we have? I think this is quite naive to think and to believe.
Hello, Hal, do you read me? Do you read me, Hal?
Affirmative, Dave. I read you.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
And I think there's another thing that is really important and that we need to realize is that when we speak about design in the digital in general and in robotics, of course, it's not about form or function. What we speak about is the interaction and the relation. Maybe even most importantly, the relation. We all know what it means to have a relation to an object. Probably you have something that you own that is really precious to you, maybe something that you inherited from your grandparents or something else that you have memories connected to. Yet it is, of course, a very different thing if that object relates back to you, you know, if it reacts to the relation that you have. And that becomes really complex, I think, and very entangled. And a very good example is Aibo, the dog by Sony, you know, that is basically slowly dying out. And we have these Buddhist rituals, burial rituals to, you know, bid those animals, objects, whatever it is, farewell. And we could argue, oh, well, but they're only objects, they're dead objects anyway. And, you know, their feelings are not true. Yes, that's true. And yet the feelings that we have as humans, the loss, the grief, is very, very much true. I think it's quite complex often and not that easy to judge.
Mm. Well, you were saying just now that those relations between people and objects, people and robots, those relations are more important than form and shape, than material things. But still, you know, they do influence material things. They do shape reality in new ways, those different relationships, you know.
I do agree with you to some extent, but not entirely, because one of our advisors, Carlo Ratti, who is an architect and urbanist teaching at the MIT, and he's a specialist on smart cities, and he says, you know, a medieval city will always remain a medieval city, of course, yet what changes is the interaction, is our way of dealing with it. And this is really what's new, and this is really what's key when we speak about robots. What is a robot? Again, Carlo Ratti suggested a very interesting definition, because there is no one definition of what a robot is. And he suggested a robot needs to meet three criteria only. One, it needs sensors that are tools or apparatus that collect data. Two, it needs intelligence, that is a software that interprets the collected data. And then three, it needs actuators or actors. That's again tools or apparatus that generate a reaction that we can measure physically. So that would be, for example, movement or light, temperature, sound, whatever. I think rather than changing the physical world in a way that is very ostensibly visible, so we realize, oh, this looks different, so it must be different, I think it really will rather change our world in a much more subtle way.
Mm. But where do you think this is all going? It's a very stupid question, I know, but is technology going to change everything?
The exhibition that I did before this one was about design and architecture and contemporary in Africa. When I finished my research for that exhibition, I was like, yes, this is great. There's something great. This is happening, and it's going to be awesome, and we're all going to be the same. And then 50 years of humanitarian aid, and I was super excited. And at the end of this research, I'm really like, I don't know if I want this. It's not necessarily a bright future that we're looking into.
Are you the legal guardian of John Connor?
Our thanks to Alexei Korolev for that report. Before we take off, here are a few stories we're watching this week. In the third issue of our August newspaper, we visit the Italian seaside town of Cencenatico for a look at how this pastel-hued playground of mid-century signage might point the way to the importance of architectural preservation. We also visit the Japanese city of Ueda to ask why people have plumped for the area's famous buckwheat noodles, and of course its wood-heavy Sanshitsu Zakuri architecture, and are settling down in this former silk town. We also mull over how the Swiss firm Milo cornered the Zurich outdoor furniture market, and head to the fjordside headquarters of Oslo-based design firm Snøhetta to find out how it's exporting spot-on Nordic design to the rest of the world. Section D was produced by Ben Rylan and edited by the ever-patient Alex Funnell. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.